Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, September 24th, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. We come to you each week from the Futures Lab studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute to talk about what's making headlines on the media beat. This week, we'll talk about some comments NBC political editor Chuck Todd made on MSNBC's Morning Joe about the role of reporters. What did he mean exactly when he said it wasn't his job to inform the public? Pope Francis gave an interview to the Jesuit magazine The American that grabbed even more positive headlines for the pontiff. He's had quite the honeymoon period with the flock and the press alike since assuming the papacy. I'll ask our panel what seems to set him apart and if it's likely to last. Apple released the iOS 7 operating system. It has some new features the company is quite proud of, but some vulnerabilities too. We'll look at those bugs and debate whether you should upgrade now if you haven't already or hold off. And a University of Kansas professor says he was being deliberately provocative when he tweeted the NRA, putting last week's Navy Yard shooting squarely on the organization's shoulders. There's a lot more we'll try to squeeze in before our time's up, but let's start by talking about Chuck Todd. There's no question he's had a tough week, first for retweeting and then retracting a colleague's work during that Navy Yard shooting, and then for comments he made during a back and forth with former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. They were talking about the public's misunderstanding of certain aspects of the Affordable Care Act.
If you took 10 people from different parts of the country who say they're against the bill and sat them down, I'd love to have 10 minutes with them and say, "Why? Tell me why you're against the bill." And if they told you anything, it would be stuff that's incorrect.
It's incorrect.
But more importantly, it would be stuff that that Republicans have successfully messaged against it, and they wouldn't have even heard. They don't repeat the other stuff because they haven't even heard the Democratic message. And what I always love is people say, "Well, it's your folks' fault in the media." No, it's the President of the United States' fault for not selling it.
So, how do you interpret those words?
Well, first of all, I think on the narrow sense, Chuck Todd is right. His critics saying it's not our job to ferret out the truth or expose lies. I don't think that's what he was saying. He was saying when it comes to selling the message for whether Obamacare is a good thing or not, it's the White House's job to do that, not the media. On the other hand, I think, you know, that reaction to all of that is pretty typical. I mean, you know, it almost all came from the left saying, "Why don't you want to expose the lies of the right?" Well, if you'd had the political correspondent for Fox News saying on Fox News, "You know, I don't think it's our job to try to expose what the administration lied about Benghazi or whatever," then you'd have Republicans saying this very same thing. But it is not our job to be the spinmeisters for the politicians.
Yeah, I think part of the problem you have here as well is that you have Chuck Todd, who is the White House correspondent for NBC News, on MSNBC talking about it in the political realm. And that creates a certain problem. And this isn't the first time that Chuck Todd has ran into these issues. And a lot of it centers on the fact that he's trying to do both of these jobs at the same time, be someone who is knowledgeable in the political realm on MSNBC, while at the same time having some sort of objective sort of reporting done on NBC News. And it keeps creeping back and forth.
The thing I really had a problem with in that conversation, though, was not with Chuck Todd's interpretation or his reporting in general, but it's just the notion that so much of what they talk about on these shows is just about process. It's this elitist viewpoint for an elite audience. Oh, don't we all care about all the machinations and the spin and all of that? And the assumption, and you heard it more in Ed Rendell's voice, at least in that clip you showed, than in Chuck Todd's, but it's basically that, you know, the folks out there are really kind of stupid or they're sheep, and whatever messaging is put out there, if we don't expose the lies, then the public won't see through it. And I think that's wrong, too.
I do want to say that I don't think that the government, and when I say the government, I'm talking about not just the Obama administration, but the government in general, has not done a very good job of educating the public about the Affordable Care Act. It's supposed to kick off next week, mm-hmm. and there are still aspects of it that the public doesn't understand. And then when you have these polls coming out that's saying that a majority of the public doesn't necessarily agree with it or they don't support it, well, that's a blanket statement that doesn't really get to the fact that there are certain aspects of the Affordable Care Act that people do like, but they just don't know enough about it.
So if the government isn't doing a good enough job of doing that and of informing the public, does it fall then, Ernest, on us as media to step in and to begin to change some of that and to inform the public? Looking at the SPJ Code of Ethics, it says one of the charges we have as journalists is to test the accuracy of information from all sources.
Well, I think we do have a responsibility for that. I think we do have a responsibility to help educate the public. But it goes back to what Mike was saying. We tend to want to look at it from the political realm, from this horse race kind of, well, the Republican said this, the Democrat said that, instead of looking at, here is a program, first of its kind, where you're actually going to have health care mandated. What does that mean? How does that help you as the public determine what health care is right for me and my family? That's the story. That's what the media should be doing, not the horse race. The Republicans are saying this about Obamacare and the Democrats are saying that.
No, I agree completely. And I mean, I think that some journalists are doing a good job of exposing the complicating issues around the Health Care Act. I mean, for example, there's a good story on NPR this morning about, you know, what's really the crux of Obamacare, that in order to cover these people who need health insurance but aren't going to get it, people who are healthy, like young people, are mm-hmm. going to pay more to subsidize people who can't afford it. I mean, that doesn't mean it's a bad idea or a good idea, but it's a story we need to tell. I've seen media reports about how the insurance industry is really going to be the prime beneficiary in some aspects for the Affordable Care Act. That's a story that needs to be told, too, not because it's a Republican or Democratic talking point, but because it's a substantive issue surrounding the Affordable Care Act.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to point out that, you know, there are good stories out there. I mean, one of the stories that I think is fascinating is the fact that what's going to happen when people find out that in one state you're going to be able to get the Affordable Care Act and it's going to really work for you, whereas in a state like Missouri, where it's been basically fought by the Republicans to the point where they're just not going to play along. What is that going to do in terms of population? People may wind up moving to states like Colorado or California or somewhere like that, who has decided that they're going to provide health care for the public.
And make it.
And so what kind of impact is that going to have?
Environment. Well, over the weekend, we saw and heard about the horrors as a group of gunmen entered an upscale Nairobi shopping mall, killing dozens and holding hundreds hostage in a standoff going on for days. New York Times photographer Tyler Hicks lives in Kenya with his wife, also a photojournalist, and was shopping at a mall across the street when the gunfire rang out. He grabbed his camera and made his way into the building.
There was men in front of a bank, and a woman just out in the middle of the mall, covered in blood. So it was definitely serious, and the gunmen still at large, still in the mall, but nobody knew where they were.
The photos Hicks and his wife took are unimaginable. We've linked you to the New York Times' full gallery on our blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. Ernest, the images that we're seeing there, they're captivating. They're bringing home a story that has really captured the American attention in a way that other stories we haven't seen, like Syria, like Egypt. What is it about this one, about these photos? What's doing that?
I think one of the reasons is that the narrative can of this story, people can actually see it themselves. They go to the mall on a Saturday to do some shopping, and then all of a sudden, you know, violence breaks out. In a lot of ways, it's not different than some of the mass shootings that we've had here in this country. So that, I think that's the connection that Americans are seeing right now. It just happens that it's happening in Africa as opposed to happening in Colorado or Connecticut or anywhere else in this country.
I think the story also shows the value of having trained photojournalists. I mean, there were lots of people there, I'm sure, in that mall who had cell phone cameras, but they were wisely, if they could, fleeing that place. And yet we had these two photographers running into the scene. I mean, the wife went back to get the flak jacket or whatever and bring the better cameras, but they're following these cops and soldiers around, peeking around every corner, could have been shot at any moment. The courage that they exhibited as part of their sort of professional ethic to get those kinds of images is important.
I also think that, you know, the news media is doing a better job of covering these issues because it's happened so much. So now they're getting the context and they're providing information and they're showing the video and the photos in the proper context from both the aspects of the government as well as, you know, what are the actual terrorists? What are they doing? Who are they? What is their history? This sort of thing. So you're getting a lot more of that information that where usually, you know, you're getting this back and forth. This is how many people were killed. This is what they're going to do now. You're getting that, but you're also getting more context. And I think that really helps the public have a better understanding of what's going on here.
Well, there are some people in some circles that are already starting to make predictions that these photographs could be among Pulitzer winners for the year. Any thoughts from you guys on that at this point?
It's hard to predict. It's too early to say whether or not that's the case. But like, I go back to what Mike was saying. Yeah. I think that they should be commended for the work that they've done because you're going into a situation where you don't know who's friendly and who's a foe.
Okay. Well, The American, a Jesuit magazine, printed an exclusive interview with Pope Francis last week. It caught the world's attention for being what is interpreted by some as softening on gay rights issues, abortion, and birth control. Church officials maintain the interview wasn't giving away any changes in church doctrine. But one thing it is showing, this pope isn't afraid to speak up, speak out, and be among the people. The magazine's editor talked to Howard Kurtz about that on Fox News Channel's Media Buzz.
It is a new genre in papal communication. Other popes have given interviews before, but they have been heavily redacted. They've been heavily censored. They have been didactic, and they've been paternal. You know, but in this interview, the Pope is really speaking to us more as a brother. He's speaking to us in a more intimate way. It's not philosophical. It's not theological. He's speaking to us from the heart. And so between this interview and the interview on the plane, I think we are seeing the birth of a new genre of papal communication, one that is really better suited, I think, to the temper of the times, particularly, an age that really values authenticity.
So this pope has had quite a honeymoon period. Very few criticisms, very few negative headlines out there. What is it that you guys are seeing about Pope Francis that the media seems to be glomming onto him so positively?
I mean, I do think one of the words that the commentator there used, authenticity, is something that people are hanging on to. Because if you were to go in and actually read that entire interview, you can tell that his opinions, the things that are being highlighted about what he's saying about gay rights and birth control or whatever, are not just talking points or a new strategy, although they may be those things. But they flow rather naturally from a very sort of intellectual thought process that the Pope appears to be going through. So I do think people are seeing that authenticity. But I also think that a lot of folks in the media resonate with his message politically. And almost all of the coverage that I've seen so far in mainstream media sees what he is saying about birth control and gay rights and abortion as being correct.
I also think what you're seeing here is that you're seeing access. People are actually seeing the Pope, and they're just not seeing him in the Pope Mobile or in front of large crowds. They're seeing him interacting with people. They're seeing him interact with the media. And he's trying to build a rapport with the media because I think he understands that that's the way he's going to be able to get his message out, which is different from the previous Pope. It sort of goes back to Pope John Paul to a certain extent and what he was doing with the media at that particular time. Now you're in another media era and it's changed and reaching the public is different. And I think this Pope has sort of figured that out, whereas the previous Pope really didn't have that connection.
You get the impression that what the Pope is saying resonates with the majority of American Catholics, at least as public opinion polls have shown them to feel about certain issues. And it was kind of interesting, too, I think, because I believe what the Pope at least what they say he is trying to do, is to reach out to a new audience, to bring back lapsed Catholics, to get younger people interested in the Catholic Church. And clearly, he seems to be playing to the right audiences. I mean, last night, for example, Stephen Colbert was interviewing the editor for this magazine that published the Pope's interview.
Same person that we just saw there.
Right. Basically talking about, in a format that young people are going to appreciate on a program they watch very regularly, not news programs, mm-hmm. what it is that message is all about.
And the other thing I think is that the Catholic Church itself is starting to move away from the era of the scandals of all the things that they've had to deal with in terms of the priest situation and the leak, the lawsuits and that sort of thing. They've handled all of that internally as well as through the legal process and paying people for fees and that
and
sort of
settlements.
Thing. And settlements and lawsuits and that sort of thing. So he's trying to move the church away from that to a more open environment and bring back, as Mike was saying, lapsed Catholics and those who were turned off by what was happening in the church.
I don't think that the media are necessarily downplaying this, but one of the things we should make clear, if it isn't clear, the Pope is not necessarily saying that he disagrees with the doctrines of the church with regard to abortion and birth control and homosexuality. He simply was saying, at least in this interview, we have to focus on other things besides
that. We've become obsessed with some of these issues as opposed to having them in their rightful place or proportion.
And that obsession has turned a lot of people off. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he's trying to do is bring that back in. So I think Mike is absolutely right. It's not that the Catholic Church is not going to deal with those issues, but there are other things out there that people should be aware of, that the Catholic Church is doing a lot of good things that they're doing that they don't get credit for because people are obsessing on these other issues.
Okay. Well, we often talk about journalists getting themselves into trouble using social media. This week, it's a journalism professor who's making a name for himself for what he's put out on Twitter. David Guth has taught at the University of Kansas Journalism School since 1991, focusing these past few years on strategic communication. Last Monday, he tweeted in response to the Navy Yard shooting, saying, "The blood is on the hands of the NRA. Next time, let it be your sons and daughters. Shame on you. May God damn you." Guth isn't apologizing for what he put out there, telling Kansas City's KSHB-TV he knew what he was doing.
"I was deliberately provocative, and I did expect to provoke a response. Well, I'll be honest, I didn't expect to provoke the response I've gotten now, but I have nothing to apologize for."
His words weren't too popular with gun rights activists, members of the state legislature, or students on the KU campus.
"As a professor of KU, he represents our school. He represents the student body. And speaking negatively about people in some debatable occasions, you should probably hold back, or at least consider the consequences and consider your every word."
There is so much for us to talk about here. I don't even know if I know where we should start. The student had this point. If your student is saying to you, think about the consequences of what you're saying, yeah.
I'm with you. I, when I read it, I was just stunned. And I understand that he has an opinion and he has a right to express that opinion. But I think he went a little bit too far in bringing in the sons and daughters. That whole aspect of it just really sort of turned me the wrong way. I mean, yes, you have a First Amendment right, but you also are a professor in a journalism program where you should also understand that the students are going to look at that. Their parents are going to look at that. The university as a whole is going to look at that. What was the message that you're sending? I still, to this point, even looking at that clip, I don't understand.
Yeah,
what
I don't know if I understand it either. Mike, let me ask you this. So he has the First Amendment right. Mm-hmm. What is his responsibility as a journalism instructor to model different behavior?
Well, I mean, I don't have a problem with him expressing his opinion, depending on especially what it is he teaches. If he were the equivalent, say, here in our journalism school of the news director of KOMU or the managing editor of the Missourian, then he would have no business saying that in a class. But he says he's teaching strategic communication. I don't know. He does have a First Amendment right. And I don't think, frankly, even if he had left out the sentence, essentially, I hope it's your kids next time, that he wouldn't have gotten the same sort of reaction from the NRA and people who support that. Still, I think it's pretty interesting how the universities reacted, and he provided them an opening. They've put him on, you know, administrative leave, paid administrative leave. Does that mean that they are, that's a step toward getting rid of them, or does that mean that's a step that's aimed at sort of tamping down the complaints? And when we go on to the next subject sometime a few months later, he comes back? I don't know.
Well, and according to the Associated Press, he was supposed to be on a sabbatical to be doing some research during the spring semester. So there's some debate as to whether or not he has gone on sabbatical early. He's kind of intoning that perhaps he has. The university is saying, no, that's not the case. This is indefinite administrative leave.
Well, and again, I mean, he has a First Amendment right to say what he wants to say. That doesn't mean that he has a right to be free of criticism for what he says.
And that's,
consequences are important.
There are consequences. I mean, you can you know, take your right and use it any way you want, but there are going to be consequences on the other side. And the consequences here is that he's on administrative leave. But then you've got to think about what is the journalism school, you know, they're going to have to deal with this. The university is going to have to deal with this in a state where there is huge gun rights. The NRA has a huge number of people who are members of it and who have a huge sway in that legislature. What kind of impact is that going to have on KU? And I think that's what the administration is concerned about. Now, how they've handled it in terms of putting him on administrative leave and whether or not, you know, they're going to be forced to take some other kind of action, that's open for debate, because you've got tenure issues and a whole lot of other things going on there.
Now, explain to our audience, too, as it relates to tenure issues and those types of things. Could this be a claim that he was acting under the idea of academic freedom?
I think that's what, in his initial response, that's what he was claiming. And those who support him is claiming that, you know, they claim that this is academic freedom. He has the right to say this. But I'm sort of still wondering what part of what he was teaching in his class does that fit in with what he was doing. If he's teaching strategic communications, how does it fit in there? If he was teaching something else, how does it fit in there? And
perhaps even his being purposely provocative was strategic.
Well, maybe so. I'm not sure. But then again, there are certain rules within academia that can basically say disqualify you or cause you to be fired. I don't think he violated any of those, at least not from what I understand from the AAUP rules and regulations.
I mean, we don't know exactly what the tenure regulations within the school at KU are. We don't know what other things that administrators who were interested in taking additional action against him might be able to dredge up. But I agree with Ernest, at least on the surface of it. What he said may have been stupid, but it isn't cause for revoking somebody's tenure.
Right. Okay.
Well, Mike, you're our mobile expert. Tell us, have you upgraded to the new iOS 7 yet?
I have on my iPhone and my iPad, but I didn't buy the new phone.
Okay. Tell me, what are some of the cool features that you think so far?
Well, I mean, it's a cleaner design, mm-hmm. iOS is. So, I mean, it's not all of these sort of what they call skeuomorphic or natural-looking icons. I think were kind of funny. It's very modern and clean. But that's just a matter of, you know, aesthetics. I think it does have a better battery life on the phone, not the iOS, the new phone. It has a better camera, and there's better camera software. That's all good. And if you buy the high-end new phone, it has this fingerprint scanner that is supposed to be a more convenient and secure way for you to access your phone.
So you bring up a good point. There have been some vulnerabilities with some of these features that are really excited about, one of them being the fingerprint scanner. There's a group that claimed that it was able to hack into it. Talk a little bit for a second about some of those security flaws that have been kind of.
Well, the two main ones, one is with the iOS itself. So whether you've just updated an old device or you bought the new one, it can allow you to get past the lock screen without having to put a password in and access certain information on somebody's phone. The other is the fact that hackers have said they can fake their way past the fingerprint scanner. But in either instance, one being easy to do, one being very hard to do, the person that wanted to do something malicious would have to actually have your phone in their possession to do it. That doesn't mean that's not a security problem, but it's not as big a security flaw as, say, being able to go in through a flaw in the software and to remotely be able to get access to information.
Well, personally, I mean, I've downloaded it to my phone and to my iPad as well, and I like the clean look. Things seem to work a little better. I can move things around a little bit better. I really like the way in which they have the your email set up, and also the way it works with Safari. And I know that there are people who have problems with Safari, and that this may alleviate some of those. I'm not sure, because you know, people just have their
everybody has their habits, their likes, or dislikes.
Exactly. But I think for the most part, the clean look is what I really enjoyed about it.
Okay. Well, while we're talking about mobile, let's talk more about mobile and online news consumption. There was an interesting piece in Digiday this week about the death of the page view. Page views are a basic web metric that allows us to know how many times a website has been seen. Sometimes you'll hear people refer to it more conversationally as a hit. Not exactly accurate, but that's kind of how some people refer to it. Now it seems unique visitors and a new metric, social lift, are being seen as more valuable. Mike, explain what social lift is.
Well, social lift is just a fancy way of saying how often was the content shared through email, through Facebook, through Twitter, through Pinterest, other social media. And there is some sense that if people are actually finding the content interesting enough to share it with others, that that person is a more valued user, reader, viewer than somebody who just goes through some link bait and clicks on something and then quickly moves on to the next.
Does that make for a more attractive product for an advertiser, do you
think? I think it would, because it gives them something in which they can actually say, okay, I know that this person is actually reading what's on the screen, and they're sending it to someone else. And if they're sending it to someone else, then they're going to also see the advertising that's a part of it as well. So that gives advertisers a little bit more information about not only who's looking at it, but how much they really enjoy it enough to send it to someone else. And I think advertisers are going to like that.
I do think that, you know, this focus, additional focus on engaging the audience is important, because if we want people especially to consume longer form content or be regular consumers of what we do have to get them engaged with us. And I don't think that's a disparaging term to say engage with our brand. That's mm-hmm. important. On the other hand, if anybody thinks that sort of these page view bait things like slideshows on websites are going away anytime soon, I think they're wrong. You can look at any news website today, traditional or non-traditional. There are plenty of places for link bait there. Yeah.
I think this is just another tool that the media can use to help advertisers figure out how they can connect with consumers.
Well, here's another one, too, that could be coming up in the next year. For the first time, the Nielsen Company, the one that measures television audiences, is going to begin counting viewership of programming delivered on phones and tablets starting in 2014. This has to be great news for the networks.
Yes and no. I mean, Nielsen is a monopoly, so they can wait another year before they roll out this service, despite the fact that the TV networks want it. The other thing I'm worried about is that Nielsen is not going to be measuring live mobile streaming when the commercials within that stream are different from what's on the air. The whole point of online advertising is to target ads at people. So if you can't count that, you're not really doing a great service to broadcasters, I think.
And I think the Nielsen monopoly is really the issue here. And the fact that they can roll it out whenever they want to. What do you really get out of that in the end? I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, we've talked a lot in the past about people cutting the cord, and we're also finding that colleges and universities are doing that too. You can read more about that on our links blog, Northwestern University being among the first to stop having cable in the residence halls. Like always, we're out of time before things to talk about. Thanks to you for listening and watching. There's more background on all of today's topics on our links blog under the talk shows tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there, or send them to us via email at views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show, and KBIA's Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to tune in next week when Mike, Ernest, and I have another edition of Views of the News.